Romans chapter 1, we pick up our text in verse 18 this morning. We're going to consider just four verses. I'm going to go ahead and read the text so we have it in front of us, and then we'll do a brief review and then try to get a little bit of the big picture of where we're headed here in the book of Romans as part of an introduction, and then we'll jump into these verses. Romans chapter 1. Beginning verse 18, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness, because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God hath showed it unto them. For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. You'll notice, as we considered last week, that beginning back in verse 16, there's a whole string of verses beginning with for or because. So Paul is laying out some interconnected thoughts here, and I'm going to try to sort of outline it that way as best I can. That's why a lot of the thoughts, the way that your outline is presented there, may be presented in a question form or using why. Looking back by way of review, we would ask the question, why is Paul ready to preach the gospel to those that are at Rome? Verse 15, because he's not ashamed of the gospel. Verse 16, why is he not ashamed of the gospel? Well, because it's the power of God unto salvation, again in verse 16. How is the gospel the power of God unto salvation? Because in the gospel, the righteousness of God is being revealed, verse 17. And we considered that phrase last week, the righteousness of God. We looked at that in detail last week. Is it simply an attribute, righteousness? Or is it something that is given to us? God gives to us the righteousness of God. Or is it an action of God? And we look back at the Old Testament to consider that thought. And we summarize it this way. The righteousness of God is God acting to bring people into right relationship with himself. The result of God's acting is men receiving his righteousness as a status. This saving action of God and giving men his righteousness is the only way that men can have righteousness with God. Note that the gospel is the power of God unto salvation to those who believe. Not just everyone, although everyone who does believe experiences that power of salvation, but it's only to those that believe. The power of God in exercising saving action and bestowing righteous status is accessed by faith to those that believe. Those justified by faith shall live. Now, God's righteousness as the righteousness of faith, or righteousness that's obtained by faith, that's going to be the theme of chapter 1, verse 18, all the way through chapter 4, verse 25. Righteousness and the words related to righteousness, words like justify or righteous, occur 24 times in that section. Interestingly enough, faith and the verb believe occur 27 times, and it's often tied to those words connected to righteousness. So the action of God in giving men right status before him by imputing his righteousness will be tied to faith or to belief. And we already considered that briefly last week, from faith to faith. But before we get into this theme of God's righteousness as the righteousness of faith, there's another theme that must be addressed. Really, the whole thought of righteousness by faith doesn't become central to Paul's argument until chapter 3, verse 21. turn over in your Bibles and look at chapter 3, verse 21. It says, but now the righteousness of God without the law is manifested, being witnessed by the law and the prophets. Now the righteousness of God without the law is manifested. That sounds very familiar to chapter 1, verse 17, right? For therein is the righteousness of God revealed. The righteousness of God revealed, the righteousness of God manifested. So there's almost like this section from chapter 1, verse 18, all the way into chapter 3, where he stops this thought in verse 17. He comes back to it in chapter 3, verse 21, and there's a whole section in between that deals with something different. So what is this whole section from chapter 1:18 to chapter 3, verse 20? What's that all about? Well, we're going to see very clearly as we work our way through that section that sin, wrath, and judgment take center stage in Paul's explanation here. Before Paul can explain the good news of the gospel, he has to explain why it is good news. In other words, he must explain the bad news. The bad news. Why does man need saving? Why is Paul so excited about this gospel that's the power of God into salvation? What is it that man needs saving from? Before the good news of a cure can be explained, the bad news of the sickness has to be revealed. Before the good news of imputed righteousness by faith can be revealed, the absence of that righteousness and the presence of sin must be revealed. You know, only if sin is to be the dominating ruling force that Paul presents it to be in this section, 1:18 through 3:20, will it become clear why God's righteousness can be experienced only by humbly receiving it as a gift, i.e. by faith, by faith. One commentary put it this way, only those who are prepared to acknowledge that they are unworthy can put faith in the giver of grace. So in this first section here, 1:18 through 3:20, Paul's going to show that both Gentiles and Jews are under this dominating power of sin. Sin that deserves wrath and judgment. And this is a theme that's going to work its way all the way through the book of Romans, this relationship of both Gentiles and Jews here in this section to the need of the gospel and later to the gospel itself as we move our way into the book of Romans. And that makes sense. Stop and think about it. A Gentile, those that he's going to address first, a Gentile might claim that he had no knowledge of God, no knowledge of sin, no knowledge of judgment. So he had no chance to exercise faith, right? And Paul's going to show that even the most pagan person has a knowledge of God, and so he is without excuse. In fact, we'll start that part here this morning in the verses we consider. So that might be the perspective of a Gentile. A Jew, and we'll get to that as we move into chapter 2, a Jew might claim exemption from judgment by virtue of their covenant privileges. The covenant people of God. So Paul's going to show, as we move into chapter 2 and chapter 3, Paul's going to show that those privileges as God's covenant people, yes, they are indeed real privileges, but they don't help them in judgment because they have broken the covenant through disobedience. And so they too are under God's wrath and God's judgment. So both Jews and Gentiles are under this dominating power of sin. Paul's indictment of humanity here, again in this section, proceeds, if you will, if you want to think of it like a target. He starts with the outer ring and then slowly works his way toward the center. That outer ring being the whole of humanity. And we see that in verse 18. The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness. So he starts with everyone, and then he moves mainly to the Gentiles, i.e. humanity apart from special revelation, sometimes we call it, i.e. apart from the law. The Jews had received the law, the Gentiles had not. Does that somehow or another excuse the Gentiles? No, they're not excused. Although that doesn't remove the Jews from that circle either. Just like a target, they're still involved in the bigger circles. They still have God's general revelation, we call it. But they have more than that. And so as we move into chapter 2, he'll narrow it down even more. He begins with the righteous person, a little bit narrower than only those that had general revelation, the righteous person. But then by the time we get to chapter 2, verse 17, he talks about the Jew specifically. He mentions the Jews. So he's going to show how that by the time we get to 3, verse 3:9, look at 3:9. He's going to show, what then are we better than they? No, in no wise, for we have before proved that both Jews and Gentiles, that they're all under sin. They're all under sin. So Paul's whole point in this section is to show why the good news is necessary. His point is the bad news. We're all under sin. Whether you're Jew or Gentile doesn't matter. We're all under sin. That's why men need saving. So going back to verse 18, let's begin with the question, why is there a need for the good news? Because the wrath of God is being revealed, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men. Why do men need saving? Why is there this need for good news? Why is Paul so driven by this good news of the gospel? Because the wrath of God is being revealed. Revealed, it's the same verb that we looked at last week in verse 17. Means to uncover. Uncover. The verb is in the present passive indicative as well, just like it was in verse 17. God's wrath is currently being revealed or uncovered. And just like God's righteous work of salvation is being uncovered in the sense that it's being played out on the stage of human history, so is his wrath being played out on the stage of human history. In other words, and again, we considered this thought last week, this revealing is not just the revealing of a fact for the intellect. No, it's more than that. It's the uncovering of what God is doing in human history. In fact, most of the reason why I would suggest that the reveal in verse 17 is not just intellectual facts is because it's very clear when we get to verse 18 and the rest of the chapter that the revealing or the uncovering of God's wrath is not just intellectual facts. As the chapter unfolds, we're going to see that it's actions of God against mankind. You say, how is God's wrath being revealed or uncovered in the present? You know, we often think of God's wrath in terms of the final day of the Lord, to use an Old Testament term, and as it's unfolded in the book of the Revelation, right? The final day of the Lord as revealed in the book of the Revelation. And that certainly will be a day of wrath. Revelation 19:15, out of his mouth goeth a sharp sword, and with it he should smite the nations. He shall rule them with a rod of iron, and he treadeth the winepress of the fierceness and wrath of Almighty God. So yes, certainly, when we think of God's wrath, we would think of the final day of the Lord when he sets the record straight for the final time. But it's more than that. That's in the future. How is God's wrath being uncovered in the present? In the present. And that's going to be explained in more detail as the chapter unfolds. Namely, in God's actions of giving men up to their chosen way of sin and its consequences. You see that in verses 24, 26, and 28. And we're not going to get to those verses today, but certainly that's part of God's wrath being uncovered in the present. God giving men up to their sin and its consequences. The big picture is this. How is the unfolding of God's wrath seen today? Now, the big picture is this. The present experience of God's wrath, as it's going to be unfolded as we work through this chapter, is merely a foretaste of what will come on that final day of judgment. And that foretaste should drive men to place their faith and trust in the good news of the gospel. The connection between verses 17 and 18 is this: the wrath of God falls more deservedly than ever before on people now that the righteousness of God has been revealed. To reject that revealed righteousness now brings even more deserving of wrath. Notice that this wrath of God is revealed from heaven. Now, that's an interesting phrase. What, or maybe we could say who, is in heaven, and why would wrath from heaven be significant? Obviously, central to heaven is the presence of God. He's there seated on his throne. Again, we see that book in the book of the Revelation. The world likes to think that the physical universe around us is all that there is. That's it. Just what we can see, what we can feel, so on and so forth. If this physical universe that's around us, just what we can see is all that there is, then there's no accountability, right? But this physical world is not the only reality. There is a heaven. There is a heaven. There is a God in heaven. And the God of heaven is seated on his throne. And he rules as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. That means that we are accountable to him. And this wrath that is being revealed, uncovered, is being issued from his throne room, if I could put it that way. The wrath of God revealed from heaven. So, well, why is the wrath of God being revealed? Why is the wrath of God being revealed? Well, go on in the verse, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men. These two words, ungodliness, unrighteousness, they're related and they're intertwined, but they have slightly different shades of meaning. Let's start with the broader term, unrighteousness, and then we'll move toward the narrower term of ungodliness. Unrighteousness has the idea of failure to adhere to moral principles, commands, or laws. Failure to adhere to moral principles, commands, or laws. In fact, the word literally is the prefix a or a, without, and the word right or the word justice. So unrighteousness is literally without rightness or without justice. Unrighteousness. Ungodliness is a form of unrighteousness. It's unrighteous by virtue of a failure to give the proper position to God that he deserves, okay? It's not doing the right thing by not giving God the glory that he rightly deserves. A failure to do what is right by not giving God the proper respect and worship. Ungodliness. Now, when you combine those two ideas that presented by those words, this is what you end up with. Man has failed to do what is right, unrighteous, by not giving God the proper respect and worship that he deserves, ungodly. If you put that whole phrase together, then it looks something like this. God's wrath is being uncovered, it's being revealed on the stage of human experience, against or in opposition to a failure to do what is right by not giving God the proper respect and worship that he deserves. Note, by the way, the modifying phrase of men, the unrighteousness, ungodliness of men. It's men who have failed to do what is right by not giving God the proper respect and worship. It's not that God's wrath is simply just against men. If it was, he would have never revealed his righteousness by sending his son. It's against men's ungodliness and unrighteousness that wrath is being revealed. Maybe we could simplify it this way. God's wrath is being revealed against men because they're not glorifying God. Which then leads us to the question. Again, notice all the fours and the becauses. Leads us to the next question. How are men not glorifying God? Or how are men ungodly and unrighteousness? Well, look at the end of verse 18. The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness, unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness. How are men ungodly and unrighteous? They suppress the truth. The verb hold has the idea of holding in restraint, keeping within limits. Has conceived of as physically holding something down to prevent, to hinder, restrain. And thus I use the word suppress in your outline there. How are men failing to glorify God? How are men ungodly and unrighteous? By suppressing, holding down, seeking to restrain or to hinder the truth. We can understand that concept, right? We have laws against that sort of thing. It's called obstruction of justice. Obstruction of justice. Or you can think of it this way. Obstruction of rightness. So, Paul further describes the people who are guilty of ungodliness and unrighteousness as those who suppress the truth of God. Now, there's an important thing to keep in mind as we consider that thought. Truth in the New Testament, really truth throughout the Bible, is not simply something to which people give mental assent. It's something to be done or to be obeyed. The truth does not, in fact, accomplish what God intends for it when it is not obeyed and lived by. And you know this. Belief and action are inextricably linked. You can't say, I believe this, and your actions prove otherwise. Your actions prove what you believe. You act on what you believe. That's James 2, by the way. You act on what you believe. Again, one commentator put it this way. He said, these unrighteous, ungodly that suppress the truth, they do not let it develop itself into power and influence on their religious knowledge and moral condition. In other words, they don't apply the truth to themselves in their own thinking. We can simplify it even further than that. Here's the problem at the core. We don't want the truth because we don't want anybody telling us what to do. To acknowledge that anyone else has the right to set the standards, i.e. truth, to acknowledge that anyone else has the right to set the standards is to acknowledge our guilt or innocence based on those standards. So what is our response? Men suppress the truth. They suppress the truth. And notice how he describes that. They suppress the truth in unrighteousness. In unrighteousness. Men's suppression of truth is further qualified by in unrighteousness. Just in case we miss the point that suppressing the truth is robbing God of glory, Paul goes on to say that our suppression of the truth is without rightness. Without rightness, it's in unrighteousness. The very act of suppressing the truth is in and of itself an act of unrighteousness. An act of unrighteousness. So men are ungodly and unrighteous because they suppress the truth. Thus the reason for the revealing of God's wrath. You say, well, what truth is it though that men are suppressing? Well, look at verses 19 and 20. Because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God hath showed it unto them, for the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. You see, it's not just any truth that man is suppressing. It is that which may be known about God. That's the truth that they're suppressing. The point of truth that men refuse to acknowledge, that men resist, that men suppress, that men hold down, is the truth about God. The truth about God. I'm going to state an obvious fact here. God, by definition, is bigger than men. And we don't like that fact. We don't like that fact. It digs at our pride. So what do? We bury our heads in the sand and we say, God doesn't exist. God doesn't exist. Or maybe we bury our heads in the sand and we say, well, God might exist, but that really has no bearing on me, the fact that God exists. Both of which, by the way, are insane thoughts. Remember Hebrews 11, without faith, and again, we're working toward that in chapter 3, without faith, it's impossible to please God. For those that please must believe that he is his existence and that he is a rewarder of those that diligently seek him. Maybe we could look at the negative side of that. He is also a judger of those that don't please him. So we bury our heads in the sand and say, God doesn't exist. God does. Or even if he does exist, then that really has nothing to do. It has no bearing on me. But that doesn't work so well. Why? Why does that not work so well? Because it's a truth. This truth about God, it's a truth that God has shown them, according to the verse. Because that which may be known about God, he's made apparent to men, manifests. He has shown them. The last clause there in verse 19 explains that whole thought is manifest or clearly revealed is the thought behind manifest there. What can be known about God has been made visible because God made it known. God made it known. You know, what can be known about God is not some deep, dark secret hidden away only to be discovered by a fortunate few. No, that's not the case. The truth about God has been made apparent, manifest in or among, because God himself made those truths apparent. He made those truths known to men. Now, here's the thing, and we're jumping ahead just a little bit, but I think you'll catch the point. Here's the thing. Anything that God has made apparent, no one can say that he didn't make apparent. Anything that God has said, I made that apparent, no one can say, well, I didn't know. Which then, in turn, leads us to the next question. What are those truths about God that he has made apparent and that he has showed unto us, according to the verse? And this is where we move into creation, verse 20. Notice the four again. The invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made. So he's continuing this close chain of reasoning about the knowledge of God that he began back in verse 19. He has asserted that what can be known of God is visible, it's manifest among people generally. And this is so only because God has acted to disclose himself. He has chosen to make this manifest. Now he explains how it is that God made this disclosure. How is it that God made this information known to man, if you will? How has God disclosed himself? Simply put, through creation. Through creation. Who he is, i.e. the invisible things of him, who he is clearly seen through what he has created. The things that he has made is the way it's put in the verse there. The attributes of God are understood by the things that he has made. Now, to follow Paul's line of reasoning so far. God's wrath is being revealed from heaven because of the ungodliness and unrighteousness of men. Men are ungodly and unrighteous because they suppress the truth. The specific truths that they suppress are the truths that may be known about God. These truths God has made apparent to them through his own work and showing it to them through his creation. So what is it specifically that man refuses to acknowledge about God? What are the truths about God that he suppresses that are clearly seen in creation? Well, first of all, God's power. God's power. Now, here we are back again to man's response. We don't like things more powerful than us. Why? Because it means on some level that we're not in control. And we like being in control. But God's creation makes abundantly clear that he's more powerful than we are. By the way, the word for power there is the word dunamis. We've considered that word many times. Power inherent in something due to its nature. And also note that that power is described as eternal power. Eternal power. Creation itself points out that God is more powerful than we are. Let me state the obvious. We cannot make anything from nothing. We can't do that. In fact, we have a law of physics that states that matter or energy, of which matter is a part, we now understand. Matter can neither be created or destroyed. First law of thermodynamics. We can't create something from nothing. You say, well, duh, God can. That means he's more powerful than we are. And even if you stop and think about it, even beyond our inability to create is our inability to understand what God has created. What did God create on the first day? Let there be light. There was light. And we're still struggling to comprehend what light is. Is it a particle or is it a wave? So obviously God is more powerful than we are. You know, to say that God's power is clearly seen and understood by creation, that's almost an understatement. Only someone whose thinking was bent on futility would deny that. And I use those words on purpose because we're going to come to those in just a second. So obviously, through creation, we learn that God's more powerful than we are. Not only God's power, though, but also his deity or his Godhead, his divinity, the quality or characteristics pertaining to deity, his Godhead. By the way, note the little word from in that phrase, from the creation of the world. Paul's usage of this word would suggest that it has the temporal meaning. In other words, God's invisible attributes have been seen since the creation of the world. In fact, most translations translate it that way. Stop and think about that for a second. Certainly what God has created speaks of who he is. And the second phrase there, the things that are made, makes that very clear. Okay. But also his works that have been taking place since creation speak of his character. Paul put it this way in Acts chapter 14. He was speaking to the people in Lystra there. He said this in Acts 14, 17. Nevertheless, he, speaking of God, nevertheless, God left not himself without a witness, in that he did good and gave us rain from heaven, fruitful seasons, filling our hearts with food and gladness. What's Paul trying to say there? How God has acted since creation also speaks to who he is. And I'm talking about outside of special revelation, outside of the law, outside of the Old Testament, outside of the New Testament. How God has acted since creation also speaks to us of who he is. The characteristics of God that pertain to deity are also seen from or since creation. God's good gifts of life and provision speak of his love. God's common grace, we often call it, speaks of his long suffering. The way that his creation works speaks of his orderliness, his creativity. The heavens declare his glory. Psalm 19. And the list could go on and on. The attributes of God seen since creation. You know, God in his essence is hidden from human sight. But much of him and much about him can be seen through the things that he has made and the things that he has done. And it is this knowledge of God that man wants to suppress. What's the result of that? Men are without excuse. Now, this phrase states a key element in our understanding of verses 19 and 20. Paul makes it clear here that natural revelation, what God has created and how that speaks of his character, in and of itself leads to a negative result. The fact that Paul teaches the reality of a revelation of God and nature to all people, that's very clear according to the text. The invisible things of him are clearly seen through what? What he has made and how he has acted since he made it. But it's also true that this revelation is universally rejected as people turn from a knowledge of God, and as we'll see later in the chapter, to gods of their own making. Verses 22 and following. It's really a point that we need to grab onto here. It's vital for to understand Paul's gospel and his urgency in preaching it to realize that natural revelation leads not to salvation, but to the demonstration that God's condemnation is just. People are without excuse for not giving God the glory that he rightly deserves. That's where natural revelation ends. Those who perceive the attributes of God in creation are the same as those who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. And therefore, these people are liable to the wrath of God. And again, as we saw in chapter 3, verse 9, that includes all people. All people. Nobody exists outside of God's creation, right? General revelation doesn't save anybody, but it condemns everybody. So Paul has made it clear that there's no excuse for anyone because everyone has the witness of creation. But what is it exactly that there's no excuse for? Well, that's the next verse. Look at verse 21. Because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. What is there no excuse for? Knowing God, but not glorifying God. So this verse provides the missing link of the argument back in verse 20. The refusal of people to acknowledge and worship God, verse 21, explains why the revelation of God in nature, the beginning of verse 20, leads to their being without excuse, the end of verse 20. You know, understanding God's power and divinity, God's power and Godhead, through what he has created, should lead to universal desire for man to both praise God and please God. I.e. glorify him. But when man knew God, and by the way, the word there is gnosko, we've considered that word much in the past as well, experiential knowledge. When man had this experiential knowledge of God's power and deity through what he has created, he chose not to glorify God. the revelation of God that he has through what we call general revelation, he rejects, he suppresses, he resists, and therefore he's under God's wrath. You see, the problem's not a lack of information. That's not the problem. The problem is a rebellious rejection of the information that we have. Not only is being without excuse for knowing God but not glorifying God, he's also, and this is fascinating, he's without excuse for being unthankful. Unthankful. You say, what does man have to be thankful for simply from his understanding of God through creation? The fact that this all-powerful God has blessed him over and over again with abundant blessing. Again, James put it this way, every good gift, every perfect gift is from above, comes down from the Father of lights, in whom there is no variableness, neither shadow of turning. Even apart from special revelation, the good gifts of God are clearly abundant and seen. And yet, what is our response? We're not thankful. We're not thankful. Say, what is the result of this suppressing of the truth? And that's the end of verse 21. But became vain in their imagination. Foolish heart was darkened. The word imagination there has the idea of the process of using your mind to consider something carefully. Stop and think about that. Even when men who have suppressed the truth about God, even when those men use their minds to consider something carefully, their thoughts are futile. That's what the word vain means. Useless and thus worthless. One commentator put it this way, the man who has dethroned God from his intellect becomes conceited and unintelligent. Obviously, the man who reasons from the false premise that there is no God or that that God is irrelevant will arrive at a false conclusion no matter how logical the intervening steps may be. You understand what he's saying? If you don't start with the right premise, you're always going to come to the wrong conclusion regardless of how the steps in between might make sense. Now, that's not to say that unsaved people can never discover truth. It's to say that they have no proper framework in which to put that truth. Not only are men's minds stuck in futility, men's hearts are stuck in darkness. Their foolish heart was darkened. Men's uncomprehending hearts become unable to perceive. The word foolish has the idea of lacking the ability to understand the meaning or importance of something, i.e. uncomprehending. When men suppress that which may be known about God through what he has created, think about it, they suppress any and all hope. What is worse is the fact that they're completely unaware that they have suppressed all hope. They're in darkness and unaware that they're in darkness. Therefore, there's no reason for them to seek the light. Stop and think about this. At the very center of every person, i.e. their heart, where the knowledge of God, if it's to have any positive effect, that knowledge of God must be embraced. So what is this verse saying? In that place where the knowledge of God must be embraced, and it is not, it is suppressed, there has settled a darkness that only the light of the gospel can penetrate. So that's the results of men suppressing the truth about God. All right, so let's wrap this up. Here's Paul's argument so far. He's driven by the gospel. Why? Because it's the power of God unto salvation. Salvation from what? The wrath of God. The wrath of God against what? The ungodliness and righteousness of men. How are men ungodly and unrighteous? They suppress the truth. What truth? The truth that God himself showed to them. What truth did God show to them? The truth of his power and deity. How did God show that to them? Through his creation. What was man's response to these truths that God showed them concerning his power and deity? They chose not to glorify him or to thank him. And what is the result of suppressing these truths and not glorifying God as they should? Their thinking becomes futile and their hearts become dark, a darkness that they're not even aware of. You know, to be living in a situation where all of your thought processes will be futile and your heart is uncomprehending and unable to perceive that it's uncomprehending, that's a terrible place to be. But this is where every man exists apart from the power of the gospel. This is a part of the wrath of God being revealed. Thus, the reason that man needs saving. Now, we're in a dark part of the book of Romans, and we're going to be here for a while. Just when you think that man's situation can't get any worse, it does, as we'll consider next week, Lord willing. But remember, the whole point of this section, 118 through 320, is to show the need for the good news of the gospel. The gospel is the power of God unto salvation. If you've not experienced that power, you can today through faith. If you have experienced that power, at the very least, there's a number of applications here, but at the very least, we're being reminded of what we've been saved from. Certainly part of our responsibility then, our response, is to glorify God and be thankful. Let's close in a word of prayer.